Introduction. There are so many people more qualified to write a book about hunting, but no one more qualified to write my story than me. It took me a while to realize this. I felt that in order to write about hunting, there had to be a wealth of experience and knowledge, as though only expert points of view mattered, and there was a 20-year waiting period until insight became valid. Thankfully, I had read Bill Heavey and saw that if Field & Stream would value his experiences enough to put them as the back page column in their magazine, the door was open for new hunters like me. As long as I worked hard enough at the craft of writing, I could make up for a lack of experience hunting. I started hunting during the proliferation of social media, but as the internet and podcast platforms tore down traditional barriers of entry, they also complicated things. Entrepreneurs have created incredible opportunities, but have morphed hunting into something new that presents interesting questions going forward. Modern technologies have connected us to inspiring people and more hunting opportunities than most could handle in two lifetimes. But in this, have we eliminated the contentment that used to come for the good old local hunt? Have we made hunting into a resume or checklist? Are we so worried about angles, engagement, monetization, that the historically imperative act of procuring meat becomes less about bringing home food and more about expanding our brand? Has commercialization ruined hunting like many believe it has with holidays? These are questions, not accusations or insults. Write, film, guide, buy, sell, consult, podcast, build, create, get sponsored, hunt private ranches, whatever. This is America. But we can't be naive about the potential consequences all this advertising, all this money, all this attention, all this pressure, and all the subdividing of our user group. In this book, I wrestle just as much with growth, mentorship, culture, and the industry as I do with tags because I didn't want to just write about hunts. I wanted to write about all of it. I don't claim to have anything figured out, and just because I don't like something doesn't necessarily mean it's bad or wrong. But since hunting is more than just a notch tag, as we hunters like to say, I wanted to widen the scope and attempt to explore the depth of those other areas. What follows is a compilation of original and previously published pieces from my column in the Juneau Empire, Alaska Sporting Journal, Mule Deer Foundation Magazine, and Go Hunt over the last 10 years. I was tempted to edit some of the earlier stories with the benefit of experience so I wouldn't sound so much like a beginner, but that's where I was, and that's what I wrote. 1. The process. Have you ever experienced one of those days when every cast seemed to land right in front of a willing fish, or your arrows flew toward the target like guided missiles, or you crushed 15 clay pigeons in a row at the skeet range? Neither have I. Bill Heavey. Spring Bear. By lower 48 standards, I grew up a 3-hour boat ride and a short drive past nowhere. Of course, the definition of nowhere is subjective. Contemporary clutter tricks us into believing that close proximity to a lot of stuff made by humans is somewhere, dismissing the blissful peace that comes with living rural. I grew up fishing, but not fly fishing. I picked that up in California after college as a way to make sure I was fishing legally. The intimidating nature of such strict and specific regulations made me scared to fish with one barb, let alone 3. I also didn't really hunt. My parents hunted in Colorado and Nebraska before we moved to Alaska when I was 5, but we were more of a fishing family, spending time at the river and slowly chugging our way back to the dock after the man on our boat inevitably pouted and quit on the ocean. This is what happens with boat ownership, though. You spend the money on the boat, so you better use it. In our case, the used boat Dad bought turned out to be such a piece that we only had sporadic good times to counter the stress. The fiberglass thing floated well enough, but the problem, as it nearly always is, was with the motor. Eventually, the boat became a fixture in the driveway until someone came along and bought it for $700. Even at that price, Dad felt guilty for taking so much. I always knew I wouldn't stay in California forever, but time moves, and before I knew it, I was in my late 20s. I taught high school English, coached basketball, then went home every summer to fish the rivers of my youth. The summer fishing bonanza was never stale, but I wondered about things like pursuing big game. Dad was getting less mobile, so I floated the idea of a bear hunt once I returned home in the summer of 2009. I really had no intention of killing a bear. I just wanted to see one. That was it. Drive around, drink coffee, look for bears, and allow the father-son conversation to go where it may. Maybe we'd talk about the boat, or he'd tell me about the good days of catching walleye in Prairie Lakes from the boat he sold before we moved north. Maybe he had good deer hunting stories from Nebraska that would fuel a new passion. Instead, that June, my brother scattered his ashes while I hugged Mom on Father's Day. In February, he had called from our friend Abe's boat after they caught a winter king salmon. I was out trout fishing, so there was a cool symmetry to the moment. He just wanted to share, and I was happy for the interruption. He didn't feel great, but there was a virus circulating the island, so the doctor figured that was the reason, then left on vacation. By April, he couldn't eat. And the day after he directed the spring band concert from a seat, he went to the doctor again. He was medevaced off the island and never returned. His decline slowed but wouldn't stop, and within a few weeks, I wheeled him into the pre-treatment meeting at a cancer center in Tucson. It was far too late. The decline quickened, and after one round of chemotherapy, he was gone. Contemplating how much has changed since Dad passed is a delicate exercise. Being grateful for what I had and knowing how proud he would be of what I've done is productive. Lamenting what I no longer have and what he missed isn't. While Dad was alive, I was writing a weekly column and getting a few bylines in outdoor magazines here and there, but that was about fishing. The spring bear in 2009 was supposed to be an introduction to hunting and the restart to my sporting life with Dad. I knew we weren't very likely to kill anything, but going through the process of a hunt was appealing. I missed the chance. I called Mom every day the next year and wondered about how lonely and quiet her weekends were. I thought about her going an entire day without seeing anyone, or if I was the only person with whom she talked. I wondered about my obligation to Mom, and at times wished I had moved home earlier, before Dad passed. But it wasn't Dad's death that moved me from where I knew I'd never end up. 4 years later, Mom didn't show up to work on a Monday in April. A colleague called her and asked if she was coming in. She thought it was still the weekend, so she said no. An aneurysm had ruptured in her brain as she meandered alone in the quiet, empty house. It was a miracle that she survived the initial bleed, let alone the 3 days between it and the brain surgery that saved her life. I remember the maroon folder I received in the waiting room of the hospital in Seattle that introduced me to my new life as a caretaker. When I tried to imagine what being a caretaker entailed from the seat of the hospital cafeteria, I saw the doctor who had treated Dad. I thanked him. He didn't ask how he was. Maybe he didn't remember. Maybe he did. Before I could panic too much about what my obligation to Mom was going forward, she was out of surgery, and as they wheeled her into the ICU room, she recognized me, though it was hard to recognize her. She'd be fine, but there was a trouble spot that would need to be addressed once she recovered from the first surgery. They'd operate again in October. So I was leaving California, something I knew I would do, but hadn't. I was still there, resisting the deep root growth that keeps people around, but without the courage or opportunity to leave. Obligation, responsibility, or curiosity finally sent me home. It is impossible to compartmentalize my life today because it is all complementary, or at least intertwined. I was told early in my teaching career that I should keep my home life and my work life separate. Keep who you are outside of the classroom, outside of the classroom. The people who recommended this were wrong. I have found that nothing has been more valuable to my teaching career than being a real person who has real hobbies and who can attempt to explain things like the why behind hunting. I tell kids that fishing and hunting were two things that have brought tremendous value to my life. Fishing was a coping mechanism after Dad died, and after I moved home to be with Mom, hunting was how I made it through the dark, wet, cold fall before a winter steelhead showed up. They were positive, productive things that moved me forward, and I shared that with students. In the years since, hunting and networking within the hunting industry has connected me with incredible people. Not just incredible hunters, incredible people. The ability to acquire quality meat and share adventures on mountains and in the muskegs with my wife has also allowed me to be full when I show up to work on Monday. The better I am outside of work, the better I am at work, I often tell my students, hoping what they will learn is the power of independence, confidence, challenges, and self-sufficiency that come from difficult endeavors like hunting. Where our shallow declarations and hollow affirmations fall short, real things like understanding a healthy ecosystem, game-specific habitat, cycles, weather, environmental impacts, and our place in it all makes us participants in life, not just viewers addicted to screens. I don't lament the hunt that never happened, but I think about it every so often. I think more about how proud Dad would have been with how things have turned out for me. Not so much about the list of animals I've killed, but the quality of my life, provided by the experience I've had, the people I've met, and the impact I attempt to make with the students I teach. My high school basketball coach, John Bussey, was and is a hunter. He was the one who told me about the obsession that is hunting. But I didn't have it when he invited me on a hunt a few years before Dad had passed. It was more of a camping trip. I'd simply see what it was all about, haul some meat, and that would be it. It took a truck, boat, four-wheeler, then our feet to get to the mountain Don and Jay Heppy wanted to hunt. It was a lot of work, but part of the charm of living in Southeast Alaska is sometimes going out of your way to make things gloriously more difficult or complicated than they have to be. There are deer on other mountains, but this one is special. It was warm, but there was enough clouds to keep deer from hiding in the timber until dusk. Bucks were everywhere. I had seen deer before, but never in herds like this. Don patiently sorted through, looking for one that stood out. Late in the afternoon, while Don sat and glassed, Jay and I walked to a small knob and located a nice buck. It was upright, seemingly alert, but didn't move. It stood broadside, and Jay took the shot. The buck flailed and disappeared over a cliff behind him, a cliff we hadn't seen. Jay is a builder, so he stood close enough to the edge to make me uncomfortable, but reported no sign of the buck. There was blood where it had been, but nothing to indicate where it was now. It had reacted as though it had been shot with a cannon and blown off the cliff rather than like one that is hit and hobbles or runs off. Jay walked along a steep, sheer rock face that extended past where the buck had bedded that featured half a rifle's worth of relatively flat footing and a view back toward the bed. Nothing. There were a few spots along the drop where the body could have hung up as it tumbled down to the bottom, 100 or so feet below, but it just wasn't there. The mountain had swallowed it. Early the next morning, Jay went back to look. He never found it. But Don was already out of the tent glassing. Before I could get through my peanut butter and honey sandwich, I heard the crack of Don's rifle. I looked in time to see a large buck sliding lifelessly down the mountain, hit a rock, roll, then finally come to rest. One of the antlers was broken at the base, but held on by velvet. It was a uniform 4x4 buck with a pair of eye guards. The symmetry struck me, as did the enormity of the moment. I had no problem killing salmon we were going to eat. In order to eat steak or chicken for dinner, I knew that someone somewhere had to do some killing, packing, and everything else required to get it to the store so Mom could buy it and Dad could cook it. I knew people chose to do all of that themselves, people like Don. Now I had seen it, and I knew I wanted to do it. That fall, I passed my hunter's education, bought a license, and drew an easy tag in California along with tens of thousands of others. I had purchased a rifle, shot it, bought a book on how to field dress a deer, because I hadn't really been paying attention when Don took care of his, and plotted the general strategy that necessitated getting away from other people. The problem was the further I got from one road, the closer I was to another, and at every turn I saw more camps and more empty beer cans and bottles. My first kill happened a few years later, after Dad passed and before I had become a full-fledged resident, when the tags were $150 rather than $300. It was Don who offered to let me tag along when he took his daughter up a mountain to get her a deer. I was more attentive to details this time and actively glassed, rather than just look around at the mountain as a whole. When it happened fast. There were so many antlers on so many bucks I didn't compare or measure. I chose the one on the fringe of the cluster, which had nothing behind it. I steadied Don's 270 and fired a bullet squarely through its leg. "You shot it in the leg," Don reported, in the whisper yell of an excited, incredulous hunter. The wounded deer hobbled up and over the ridge. We were 200 yards from the ridge, but the slope was steep, and the backside even more so. My world narrowed to the specific focus of finishing off the deer and fighting the humiliation of starting my hunting career with such chaos. Don's daughter Tanya, sophomore in college, shot a tall, wide forky lower on the mountain. Then, just when Don finished boning the buck out, the group of bucks had fed over the top. She shot a stud of a 4x4 before passing the rifle to me. Two clean kills on a beautiful, clear Alaska morning. Then I maimed one. Tanya and I tore off toward the ridge while Don steadily followed. What started as a run became a slow walk on heavy legs up the steep mountain. The rest of the bucks had bolted down the back slope of the mountain and were small specks just about to enter the timber as we crested. One buck had stayed behind with my buck, which was standing on a small outcropping just below us. If I killed the buck, but the buck didn't drop where it was, it would slide forever. I reloaded the rifle and steadied myself to make the necessary shot. The buck crumpled in place. There was so much to do, I didn't feel the satisfaction, joy, or euphoria that people report after taking their first buck. I'd created a mess, and before I could do much of anything, I had to clean it up. Tanya and I carefully made our way down to the buck and contemplated the brief field dressing instructions Don had told us. He didn't have the juice to pursue the buck, so he told us what to do once we finished it off. Start at the, then, make sure you don't, then, next. He had said the words, but they had no meaning. Tanya had been around the processing of bucks before, but when you're just holding legs or game bags, you don't necessarily learn. We rolled the buck onto its side and I began to cut. I don't even remember which way. By this time, the sun was brutally hot, and I was wearing the only camouflage pants I had, insulated Cabela's pants meant for hunting white-tailed deer in the cold. While I don't exactly remember the way in which I attempted to gut the deer, I did manage to remove the all-important lower digestive tract carefully. Once satisfied, Tanya and I began dragging it up the hill. We made it about 10 feet when the grade became too steep for us to be on our feet, but we were already committed and had moved it from the relative flatness of the outcropping on which it died. Let go, or lose the grip now, and it would slide into oblivion. We each grabbed an antler and on the count of three would hoist the deer as far as we could, driving its nose into the slope to steady it. Crawl a few feet up the mountain, then do it again. Looking back with the experience of taking deer, of course I could have quartered it or cut the legs and twisted the joints into a backpack. But many firsts are memorable thanks to a state of naivete or ignorance, which then become great educational motivators. The mountain relented, and I was able to drag it the last bit myself and let it rest at Don's feet. His big smile and handshake permitted a little happiness and feeling of accomplishment, which settled the chaos of the last hour. I paid more attention as Don cut away the quarters, cut the meat from the bone, removed the backstrap, addressed the ribs, and accessed the tenderloin. By the time we made it to Tanya's 4x4, the heat of the day had spurred a sense of urgency. The deer had died on impact and had been sitting in the sun for over an hour while we dealt with my buck. There was snow nearby, so we cooled the meat as quickly as Don could remove it. Finished, we slid down a chute of snow for 200 yards to retrieve the meat from Tanya's first buck, which was cooling in pillowcases on its own patch of snow. We were coming off the mountain heavy, and in the glorious monotony of measured steps with heavy packs, I knew I would do this for the rest of my life. I couldn't shake the disappointment of making the buck suffer, but I knew I would get better. Don said those sort of things happen, and I knew from the previous hunt a few years before with he and Jay that even things like losing deer happen. You don't want it to, but it does. The best you can do is be prepared enough to make a good shot in the moment, then be in shape enough to retrieve clean kills, or see the chaos to its end. Rut struggles. My initial focus and excitement while hunting typically lasts until 10:30 a.m. this time of year. I arrive at the spot. I'm as silent and as sneaky as I can be. I muster the best calls I can when I feel like it's time to call. Then about 10:30, I start to feel it. It seems like all the good hours have once again passed, and if it hasn't happened by now, it's not going to happen. Bucks don't vanish by mid-morning, but they tend to be more active in those pre-dawn and first light hours. That's when you make your move. That's when it'll happen. Excitement and confidence wane as the day wears on, and a perceived reality becomes a debilitating weight. I know there's a team of buddies stacking the gutless bodies of everything from forkies to 4 points onto the back deck of a seiner. Someone else sat down, and before she could take a sip of coffee after blowing the call, was almost run over by a hard-charging rut buck. One guy called in 2 bucks while another called in 3. Both were outdone by the dude who called in 4 at one time. Then there's the 17-year-old who opens a can of Bang, to which a 5x5 with 3 eye guards responded and proceeded to walk in sideways to maintain a broadside pose. It will all be posted online by the time I'm eating my dinner, wishing my burger was a backstrap. I indulge in this pathetic self-pity for 15 or so minutes before phase 2 of my hunt starts and lasts until the fading light of mid-afternoon. During those moments, I don't feel like I'm hunting. I'm a Snickers commercial. I'm only listening to the waves of negativity crashing against the confidence that was a rock a few hours earlier, but is now nothing more than sand. And it's not even lunchtime. Did I call too much? Not enough? What about the pitch? Should I have rattled? Grunted? Should I have called 2 weeks ago but grunted this week because hunting pressure and the onset of rut have changed the conditions? Was there a buck bedded on an edge of an impossibly loud patch of salal that I just didn't see? A buddy texted me at the end of last month to say it felt like he was the only one in Southeast Alaska not getting big bucks. He then added one of those crying laughing emojis and followed up with, "Weird how that works." He was speaking to the distortion of reality brought on by social media, but easily dismissed the trap. He is experienced and confident enough to laugh it off, refocus, and make things happen. Since that text, he's bagged 2 nice bucks. The point is not to pretend frustration does not exist, because there is such a thing as toxic positivity. I know you're tired of hearing how everything is toxic and everything is bad, but that's part of the point. It's not all bad. It's not all good. And to pretend it's simply either is a waste of time. When it comes to the inevitable hunting frustration, staying frustrated is more of a problem than getting frustrated. Using hashtag keep hammering on a social media post does not make a hunter immune to negativity. It is the cry of those who do something about the situation rather than simply feeling justified in prolonged pouting. I guess it's the same with anything, really. You start something you're really excited about, then everything seems to fall apart. There were plans and goals, and it all seems as far away as it was when you started trying. Everything worked out for that person, why not you? But success is not the absence of hardship. It's handling hardships and moving forward. It's getting easy to remember this on those weekend mornings, but I still have some improving to do if the bucks keep failing to show. Growth. A heavy, chocolate-antlered buck strolled down a small, thickly wooded hill toward the doe that was staring directly at me. I drew my bow when it passed behind a tree and some brush, but he never stepped into the lane where I was settling my pin. He stopped, checked the doe to his right, then busted. The next day, not a half mile from that exact spot, a younger buck with a compact rack raked a small cedar tree on the edge of a muskeg, but never gave me more than a tight, quartering away shot. These two bucks fueled my off-season rut dreams, and with them in mind, I returned for the first time since last season and found the road closed. Logging. I had finally put in enough time to figure out a good spot. I had found the angles, the access points, the trails, and the quietest way around all of it. I set up game cameras. If there are three tiers to hunting, beginner, intermediate, and expert, and two levels within those tiers, junior varsity and varsity, I felt as though I was about to become a varsity beginner, or even a junior varsity intermediate hunter. Now what? Without a boat, there aren't a lot of road system options around Ketchikan. I've been on plan C and D before, but last weekend seemed much further down the alphabet. Probably because all my effort went to the place that is now forever changed. Before I could be rewarded for figuring something out, I had to find a new spot and do it all again. Maybe that's a better indicator of experience and growth. It's what happens when your plan A is blown up and you have to recalibrate and be successful on the fly. The best hunters have to be the ones who are still able to make things happen regardless of what is thrown at them. They have to have the confidence and the experience to not fall apart or quit. They just make their decision and turn to the page in their build-your-own hunting adventure story. Dudes like me can't yet handle skipping chapters or hunting flow charts that look like electrical schematics. We need yes or no, with only slight deviation from the plan we concocted. So while I'm a much better hunter than I was, I wonder why I still stumble into mistakes I wish I was over at this point. Sure, it may have been because I was thrown off by the thought of game cameras being smashed by falling timber or loggers swiping them. I still should be able to refocus quicker. Anyway, something made me crest a knob like a clueless beginner on Sunday. I pictured reddish antlers reaching wider than the ears and splitting above them. This was it. Plan A was gone, but it wouldn't matter. Run this plan right. Make it work. But I crested standing up rather than crouching and crawling. Below me, down a steep 20-yard slope, was a strip of muskeg that was a protected, mostly hidden corridor between two clumps of timber. I didn't have a clear view of all of the baseball infield-sized opening, but enough to see a buck turn and bound off. I tried to stop it with my call, but it was no use. I wish I could get the growth without the lesson, but life doesn't work like that. I ambled around in the forest for another 2 hours and parked myself on a small knob in the muskeg with much less dramatic features than the one where I had spooked the buck. I had the high ground, but only by a couple feet. The slope was gentle, the view good, but there was nothing to see. I opened my pack and grabbed my sandwich. I sent a picture to my fiancée Abby, joking that the sandwich tasted like defeat. For some reason, I didn't get too down. I had little hope, but I hunted the last minutes hard and right. I hoped I would be rewarded with a buck on my hike back, but I wasn't. Nature doesn't provide pity bucks. Over par. Every Wednesday, the male contingent of the English department at my old high school in California would meet at a local golf course for 9 holes of horrible golf. There was a really nice course in town, but we felt the one filled with gopher holes that surrounded a trailer park better matched our level and style. We aspired to play bogey golf, but there would always be a blow-up hole in which someone would hit the trailer, an oak tree, or the freeway. This dramatically increased the score, but as there was no money on the line, we cheered on whoever was having the worst day. There was frustration, there were profanities, but also the realization that it didn't really matter. We re-engineered the mindset to compliment whomever was playing the worst, touting their ability to get the most out of their $7. This year my hunting has been about the same, except for spraying shots all over the place. I am going on a lot of hunts and coming back empty-handed. I hunted 31 days since August, it's November 11th, and come home with 2 deer. That's a 6% success rate. The thing is, had I shot every deer I saw, I would have been tagged out in August. My season would have been over. I would have deprived myself of more time outside. I'd much rather be 2 for 31 than 2 for 4, because there have been 27 more days afield. What's the goal here? To get hunting done as quick as possible so I can spend more time inside? I really enjoy hiking, but the end is relatively predictable. The end of the trail is the top of a mountain. The variables have to do with wildlife and atmospheric conditions. When hunting, I am engaged on a level I'm not when simply hiking. My awareness is heightened. I'm paying attention to things like the sound my boots make, the squeak of my pack, brush against the rifle barrel. I'm not just surrounded by forest, I'm looking through the trees for eyes, ears, and antlers. Doctors and psychologists implore patients and the population in general to get outside and reap the benefits of being outside. The real out, you know? Not the concrete path that leads to Wi-Fi and sugary coffee drinks. Like golf, competitiveness runs amok in hunting too. It can be embarrassing if you spend the entire week hyping up your trip and flooding your social media story with the preamble to greatness. In our announcement culture, more is at stake for the person attempting to maintain a reputation or influence. Quiet is the narcissistic hunter who bragged all week then got skunked over the weekend. That's not to say there's anything wrong with being excited and articulating it on social media, but as is the case with things like golf and hunting, much of life is about being blissfully unburdened with the score. There is a score, and you notice, but that's not the entire point. No sport expects perfection. There's only the undulation between success and failure, and the motivation behind engaging in the first place. defining moments. I read one of my first hunting articles and wanted to throw it away. When you're new to something, it can be difficult to decipher between a universal detail that will connect with the reader and something that just makes you look clueless. To look back and see that it was just a matter of newness, not a stubborn character flaw that prevents you from ever really getting it, is a relief. Still, it made me think about two of the most important lessons about hunting that I've learned. How I defined hunting, and how I handled failure. I had an unclear definition of hunting early on. I was motivated by the hunt itself, for sure, but also the creative opportunity it presented. At times, I had the attitude of a hunter who was hunting in order to write about it, rather than hunting to hunt, then writing about it. There is a subtle but important distinction there. I'm most proud about the honest tenacity with which I wrote, but occasionally I sounded like I was trying to impress people, like the objective was to become known. I think this is a common reflection for many creators in the outdoor realm. At some point, you have to grapple with what you're in it for and what you're willing to do. It's not at all bad to make a living as a guide, writer, host, or any other career in the hunting and fishing industry. But your voice is impacted by your definition. There are people who happily make YouTube videos about their hunts and don't aspire to quit their day job. It's a simple, authentic look into the life of an honest, real hunter who might not have great filming or editing skills. There are also people who have never met a sponsor they didn't like, and whatever it takes to get more justifies the means. There were times when I sounded like I was trying too hard. Push the content. Drive traffic. The availability and temptation of social media caught me a few times, and I was trying to fit in. Writing a weekly column allowed an experience to settle a bit, and I could take some time to craft a story. The story would run Wednesday, but with social media, tending to your online character is an ever-present temptation. I accepted that in order to get eyes on my columns, I needed to play the game, but I learned you have to play the game on your own terms. When I wrote about fishing, I was confident. I knew I could connect by writing about those casual moments when you know you should retie the leader. Just retie it. Just take 2 minutes and retie it. You don't. You lose the fish. Anglers know that moment. They feel that moment. I didn't have enough experience writing about hunting to recognize the universal moments of growth that would resonate with hunters. Sometimes I think I nailed it, but sometimes I stunk. Not all of my early stuff had this conflicted tone. For the most part, it is honest and doesn't fake depth or sound like someone who just wants to make money by sensationalizing or writing a story that isn't there. In the clarity of aftermath, we can say confidently that a lesson has been learned, but a lesson is only truly learned when the next time we have an opportunity to make the same mistake, we don't. As I continued hunting and writing, I started to better understand and then define hunting. I went up a mountain with my buddy Steven and shot my first 4-point buck. The next time we went, neither of us got anything, but he still said it was a good hunt. Early in my hunting career, I went with people and had success, so it seemed fairly easy. There was a baseline of effort that had to be met, and if so, success was attained, and I could write about it. Simple. But another element of the lesson on how to define hunting came when I didn't have success, especially alone. I was so naive that I really did buy into the entitled attitude that all I had to do was meet a baseline effort and I'd be often rewarded. That's far from the truth and provides a breeding ground for frustration. When Steven happily concluded our hunt without killing a deer, I saw that if a hunter as good as Steven doesn't always notch tags, it means I sure as heck won't. That hunt helped me understand that the whole program was the point. The opportunity, the hiking, the misery, the glassing, the stock, the shot. Or the realization that sometimes a hunt ends without an epic story. Still, hunting is frustrating. You think you have the perfect plan and run the program over and over in your head before you sleep, which is the worst time to do so because then you can't relax enough to fall asleep. But the hunt begins and the other variables kick in. Weather, someone else. The bull, buck, or billy don't cooperate. But there are also moments in which I had the opportunity to apply the lesson, and did. A simple shrug after a deer winded me when I was at full draw, 15 yards away. Shaking off a blown stalk on a bear to make a perfect one the next day on a bigger boar. Frustration is never solved, but it can be temporarily beaten back. This has become easier the less I define hunting as a means to create content. It's okay if the story is just mine. I don't have to try and leverage everything into meaningful copy. This mindset is liberating because it defines hunting as something I can write about, but I don't have to. And the less desperate I am for a story that will make good copy, the less desperately I will act, and the less frustrated I might feel. There's also a widening of the scope that happens as seasons stack up. It might not be exactly the inner poet that gets gushy about experience, but there is certainly a level of maturity that might not have been there from the start. Time becomes precious, not something to rush through. You can take a break on the way up the mountain, and the way back down. The story can wait. The post can wait. Right now has meaning even if the deer busted. Dead animals cannot fill the void in a life, and turning hunting into a perpetual audition for sponsors is a dead end. Prioritizing experiences that are meaningful, even personal, should be the primary motivation. It's not that I one day expect to ascend to a level of humility that will make me the most righteous, virtuous outdoors person Earth has ever known. It's that if I value the experiences the way I say I do, and know that I do, then I will attempt to grab hold of sanity in those moments when things go south or I lose perspective. You know, step back and think about how unbelievably lucky I am to have been able to hike up the mountain by myself, camp, put myself in the position to bring home my own free-range organic meat, even if I don't. There is no dignity in a tantrum or gratuitous machismo on the mountain. Over time, this becomes obvious. You look back and see how you've changed and find what drove you and how you handled success and failure have evolved since your first experience. Those are defining moments. Finding words. I subscribe to Field and Stream to read Bill Heavey. What I learned from his perspective is that all voices, regardless of ability, are valid in the outdoor world. Not that Heavey is a subpar hunter or angler. In fact, I found profound eloquence in the honest and heartfelt way he wrote about life through his outdoor experiences. He was obviously competent, but creatively self-deprecating and found subtle and not so subtle truths about the sporting life that helped me write about my life outside without fear. Fly fishing writers like John Gurek, Russell Chatham, and Thomas Wayne, among others, introduced me to the art of storytelling when you don't necessarily intend to keep all the fish you catch. The fact they didn't need a fish of a lifetime or exotic trip to evoke words was instructional. It's not always about the biggest fish in the furthest, most exclusive water. That seemed like an obvious, if not necessary, storytelling tip for a high school teacher with a limited travel budget. So I wrote about my hunting and fishing, then would pick up any book by those authors and feel inadequate. They all just seemed to be able to find words for universal things so effortlessly, even if the point was to articulate the murkiness of life. There would inevitably be some lesson about the impossibility of perfection and insight into not only becoming a better hunter or angler, but communicator of a good story. Change often comes slow in writing and hunting, so it can be hard to see just how much improvement or growth has happened until you look back. When it comes to hunting, my 10-year career seems to be an anthology of failure mixed with occasional success, as though finding the silver lining ended up being the main goal. I suppose that might make for better copy than had it always been successful, because who wants to read about someone who never fails? Conflict drives plot and reveals character. Plus, no trust should be given to people who never admit wrongdoing or failure. Insert political commentary tangent here. While writing this book, I came upon a few things I wrote that seemed like they were from the future, or at least foreshadowed the better writer I would become. Not that I am exceedingly confident in my ability with words. If anything, my self-deprecating humor or angles for hunting more closely mirror feelings of inadequacy or insecurities as a writer. But that doesn't stop me from doing either. Donald Miller wrote that when you write about your life, if someone finds it boring or uninteresting, that can feel like an indictment of your life. It shouldn't. That is more accurately a failure to articulate something in a way that appeals to a reader. That shouldn't necessarily be a problem either, because you can't write for everyone. The point of hunting, however, isn't to attempt to be a legend. It's just to tell your story and see what happens. Whether you're a writer, photographer, artist, podcaster, or an entrepreneur, you're never hopelessly adrift in the creative world. Understanding this can sometimes be the difference between taking a break that becomes longer than you intended, or pushing through towards something that will make you look back and think maybe you're not as bad as you thought or remembered.